possible without the generous support of some outside funders. And let me very gratefully acknowledge the support that we have received from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. It's made this symposium and the whole World Views Project possible. And I should mention that Carnegie pays a lot of attention to the substantive content of its project and has made invaluable suggestions to us in the course of our work. And no one has been more diligent or hardworking on this than Patricia Nicholas, who's our project manager. She has been here for almost all our public events, actually all of them, and given many intensive private ones as well, I might add, and is with us, I think, this morning, or she should be, after an early morning flight from New York City, and I want to say, Pat, we're truly grateful. Now, our Rising Powers Initiative, let me just say a few words about that now. It's made up of three different projects. Here they are. And we have two major ones. That's the World Views of Aspiring Powers, which is this one. Power and Identity in Asia, which is focused on a couple of other countries as well as the five that we're doing here. And also another one that looks at Asian powers and economic challenges, and we're doing that in partnership with the business school here. Now, I want to point out that the hallmark of all of these projects, particularly the two, is our focus on the domestic discourses, debates, and identities of aspiring powers. And our research has been designed with this in mind. So what we have are, the way that we've designed these activities is that we focus a lot of attention on the other side, the non-US side. For instance, just on the two big projects alone, we have 23 leading scholars drawn equally from the US and from each of these countries. And in fact, between all three, we have 35 researchers across Asia and the US. And I should say that this collaboration is something that we are really particularly happy about. Now, we launched the Rising Powers Initiative in April 2010 with a Washington seminar where we had our esteemed colleague Professor Peter Katzenstein of Cornell University. He addressed a big crowd of faculty, students, and guests here at the Elliott School. And today's symposium, however, is actually the first major event that we've held since then in Washington. We've already held 5 high-level workshops and seminars in China, India, and Russia in just the last 18 months, twice in China, twice in India, and one in Russia. We had experts from the host country serving. They served as commentators on all our presentations, and we had participation and audiences from a cross-section of in these countries, from the opinion leaders, strategic analysts, journalists, policymakers, and academics. And I think we all found this to be a great reality check on the work that we're doing. And I also think that it provided an excellent opportunity for local participants to shape their ongoing debates on the role of their country regionally and globally with the benefit of international perspectives that our project brings. Now, that's not to say we have neglected our Washington audience. We have actually held 4 policy briefings in Washington already with our Washington-based authors. 2 on our worldview side, and then 2 on the regional identity project. For the next phase of the worldviews project, we hope to actually step up our Washington activities and bring some of our leading regional voices to Washington to discuss their foreign policies before a DC audience. Now, I also want to note that we have published a variety of research. Let's see, going up. Whoops, sorry about that. Okay, there it is. A variety of, short policy briefs, which brings to you all synopses of research that we have done already, policy alerts that we focus on sort of breaking issues with U.S. policy implications, that we send it out to a lot of policy making community. Policy commentaries, which are basically extended op-ed piece type. And then we're also working on a manuscript that based on the presentations today. And we also have a fairly big research database that I'd recommend highly, which is ongoing listing of hundreds of books and articles related to these countries and the issues that we look at. And we also have a blog that monitors debates that are going on within these countries. So do visit us on the blog, and there's always something new on there. And before I call on my co-conspirator and co-director of this project with me, Professor Henny Now, to talk about the academic framework for this study, which will be useful as you follow the discussion throughout the day, I need to make a few quick logistical points at this moment. First of all, this is a day-long conference, and I know that people will be coming and going so throughout the day, so please bear with us on that. We also have a very tight schedule, and we seriously intend to stick to it, so please keep that in mind when we make the transitions. This is a warning to both of us as well. And finally, we have a big favor to ask of you. You will find in your folders a short survey that we'll ask you to fill out about today's event. It's just going to take a few minutes, and we'd be very, very appreciative if you could do this for us to help us out. You can drop it off in boxes outside, drop-off box for the survey. The survey is bright pink. The boxes are hot. The surveys are bright yellow. The boxes are hot pink. So I don't think you can miss it. So please do that. Take a few minutes for that. And without any further ado, now let me turn it over to my colleague Henry Now.
Thank you very much, Deepa. Let me just add my thanks to all of those who have been involved in this project. It's been a wonderful group of academic scholars, both in country and here in the United States, that is, in the foreign countries, and it's been a real spirit of cooperation. We've worked our way through some tough issues, some of which I will outline here briefly, and it's just been a real pleasure to work with the project, and especially, of course, with the Carnegie people. I suspect Pat maybe is late because of some plane problems. Pat, are you here? Pat Nicholas? Okay, probably because of some plane problems out of New York. Well, Deepa's given you the overview now of the various projects under the Rising Powers. I want to go into just a few of the issues that we had to cope with in the World Views Project, the project that dealt with the domestic foreign policy debates in the Rising Powers that we studied. We explored five questions. And I'm not going to be able to answer fully each of these questions, but I want to at least flag them for you to think about and consider as we go through the discussion of the individual country papers, because this is a comparative project where we intended to try to develop a schemata that would accommodate very diverse countries, and allowing us then in the end to have a common basis for comparing those countries and for exploring the implications of those comparisons. So we had to cope with each of these questions. And let me just briefly mention a word or two about each. First, why focus on worldviews or schools of thought? That these schools, of course, exist, and they play a role in foreign policy debate inside the United States. We're all familiar with nationalist or neo-isolationist views, realist views, liberal internationalist views, and neoconservative views. Domestic groups address foreign policy from different models or perspectives about how the world works, and they even establish institutes and journals to develop and promote that particular perspective. So we have, for example, in Washington, the Cato Institute, that generally reviews American foreign policy from a nationalist, that's not a pejorative term, by the way, in our lexicon, as you will see, or a neo-isolationist perspective, maybe a Carnegie Endowment that looks at it more often from a liberal internationalist perspective. Now, our keynote speaker at lunch today, Walter Russell Mead, popularized this idea of schools of thought in the U.S. debate. His book in 2002 entitled Special Providence received wide attention, and we've asked him to come and to offer some reflections on this concept, especially as we have now applied it to rising powers, because that was our objective. It was to try to explore the domestic debates in the rising powers and see if we could identify ongoing points of view that we could that we could track, and that we could then make some determination as to where the center of gravity was in that country's domestic policy debate and where it might likely move in the future. So we had three objectives in mind by doing this: to appreciate better the multiplicity of views in these countries and not assume that they have just a single foreign policy, track the institutional sources of foreign policy schools in these countries that maybe endure beyond individuals or particular leaders, they have points of view that keep popping up over and over and over again in these countries, and thirdly then to anticipate shifts among the various schools in these countries, thereby perhaps avoiding surprises, which usually happen when a group comes into power in some country that we did not, whose views we did not anticipate. Now, why do we focus on domestic debates? There are obviously many other factors, structural factors as well as other domestic factors, such as bureaucratic and legislative politics, that affect decision making. Now, and affect foreign policy outcomes. Now, we acknowledge that domestic debates are less relevant when international structures change significantly. When the Soviet Union collapsed, for example, India's situation changed dramatically, and that may explain, or may, in large measure, its shift towards the United States and its opening towards global markets. But international structures have been relatively stable since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And in these circumstances, we argue, domestic debates may tell us more about the direction of a country's foreign policy. Second, we also acknowledge that other domestic factors are at work, such as bureaucratic politics, and legislative politics, public opinion, personal presidential leadership, or elite leadership. They all matter. But those factors, we believe, are more important when one is trying to explain a specific foreign policy decision, what happened yesterday, or what will happen tomorrow. We are more interested in explaining changes in foreign policy over time, tracking and anticipating foreign policy shifts in a time frame of, say, 18 to 24 months, rather than 18 to 24 hours. In this time frame, other domestic factors tend to show up, we argue, to a considerable extent in the medium of intellectual discourse or debates among the various schools of thought. For example, bureaucracies have to eventually, although they may take decisions to protect their turf, they eventually have to justify those decisions in testimony and in other contexts in a more conceptual way. Moreover, some bureaucracies already reflect a particular orientation towards foreign policy. We're all familiar with the fact that foreign ministries tend to have a more liberal internationalist view, a more diplomatic-oriented view of the world, whereas defense departments have a more defense-oriented, more military, or balance of power, more realist-oriented view of the world. So if you look at any of these other actors in the domestic system of these countries, yes, there are people who are making decisions based on interests, based on bureaucratic budgets, based on simply power. But in the end, they've got to make some rationale out of those decisions, and we are trying to pick up that debate, sort of like a swarm of mosquitoes around a moving object. We see that domestic debate accompanying a series of specific decisions, and it's that debate that we want to try to track and describe so that we can anticipate the direction in which that country's foreign policy may move in the future. Now, to compare schools of thought, we had to come up with a framework that was applicable to diverse countries. And we did so in the following manner. It was not an easy task, by the way. We got a lot of headwinds from our own authors who were saying, no, that doesn't work in my country, you know. My country's unique, and you can't do that. But since this was a comparative project, we had to do it. And so we did come up with a framework in which we tried to distinguish schools of thought in terms of three major parameters. First, the scope of the foreign policy that they advocated for their particular country. The means that they advocated in order to implement the foreign policy of that country, and then, of course, the goals towards which they sought to direct the resources of their country. Now, all of these factors are relative. That is, we don't expect to find schools that are sharply differentiated from one another. But we do expect to find schools that relatively emphasize a more limited scope for foreign policy as opposed to a more expansive scope, our first parameter. Or groups that will, relatively speaking, emphasize more the military means of implementing foreign policy than the interactive, the diplomacy and negotiating or trade elements of their foreign tools of their foreign policy. We do also expect to find schools of thought that relatively differentiate between goals, sort of straight geopolitical goals, power goals, defense, and those that might emphasize more the spread of a particular culture or ideology or religion, and those that might be more interested in the consolidation of international institutions for the purpose of managing the world economy or for the purpose of solving global problems. So it's a tough job to determine exactly what is being emphasized, but that's the spirit in which we applied these parameters. Now, just to give you a sense, and I cannot go into all of these in detail, but they'll come up again now in the individual country sessions, and we'll revisit them at the end of the day in our concluding session. But here are some of the ways in which this framework helped us to identify and compare schools of thought on foreign policy in the various rising powers that we examined. In this slide, for example, we're just taking schools of thought that emphasize a nationalist scope, a limited scope, all right, for their country's foreign policy. Then we said, okay, what about those then within that nationalist group that emphasize geopolitical goals and then emphasize military means? And we come up with groups like the hypernationalists in India, the hard power realists in China, the autonomists in Japan, the nationalists in Russia. Then we might have some who emphasize political and ideology and ideological means. They still seek relatively geopolitical goals, but now they give more emphasis maybe to soft power. We come up with the offensive realists in Iran, the nativists in China, and so on down the list. Some groups that will, in this nationalist school, that will pursue cultural, religious, and ideological goals, maybe by military means. There again, we have a different grouping of the schools of thought that emerge from our country papers, the normal nationalists in Japan, the standard nationalists, and so on. Now, as I say, I'm running through this very quickly. I apologize for that. I decided to leave them all on the slide because they are going to appear in my opening chapter, and I put them together over the weekend, and I decided that I wasn't going to edit it. I was going to give you the full course, so to speak. Here are the regionalist schools of thought that you can come up with. Once again, by taking the starting with goals and then asking what means they primarily emphasize, what goals they primarily emphasize, and then what means they primarily emphasize. Here we come up with quite a number of schools in China and in Iran, as well as in other countries, the Eurasia Orthodox School, for example, in Russia, which is a subgroup of the great power balancers that the Russian paper talks about. And then we have the globalist schools, all right, in the various countries. Once again, differentiated in terms of the goals that they relatively emphasize and the means that they relatively emphasize. Now, we can come back to these slides as we go through the day. Each of the paper presenters will have a slide relevant to their particular country that will identify these different schools. So the framework worked. It has flaws, and we're going to obviously have some discussion, especially at the end of the day, about, you know, how relevant and helpful it is. But nevertheless, it worked, and it worked to some extent to our surprise, since we faced, as I suggested, lots of skepticism at the outset. Now, what we're trying to do then, the fourth question we had to face, is how do we track now shifts in these countries? All right, so we decided that, look, we'll think of these as spectrums. And we will try to see if we can identify the center of gravity of a debate in a particular rising power in terms of these three parameters and where the dominant school is located. Does it, you know, is it primarily a nationalist school emphasizing cultural means to achieve ideology or to achieve geopolitical ends? Or, for example, let's just take maybe the case in Russia today, and perhaps also in China. In both of those countries, we've observed in recent years a movement towards the nationalist end of the spectrum on scope. We've observed some greater assertiveness in the use of military means in the consensus in that country, China in the South and East China Sea, Russia in the near abroad. And we've seen some greater focus, perhaps, in both of those countries, Russia and China I'm talking about now, some greater focus on geopolitical goals, as opposed to, let's say, institutional integrationist goals, all right, in the context of the global community, especially the world economy. So our purpose, as the final slide shows, was to identify some of these shifts, all right, within our countries and then across the countries, so that we might be able to say something about what are the implications of those shifts. If countries move together in the nationalist, or let's say in the geopolitical and the military tools direction, does that lead to more cooperation or to less cooperation? More cooperation or more conflict? And all I've done in this slide, and again we'll come back to these in the discussions, is to identify several recent shifts in relationships between the United States, Japan, China, India, and Russia, and to suggest that in the case of a couple of them, I see it didn't make it, unfortunately, since I was just doing this over the weekend, in a case of a couple of these shifts, it led to some increasing conflict. For example, the shift between Japan and the United States in 2009 led to a contretemps, so to speak, in our alliance relationships. The shift in China-U.S. relationships has resulted in some greater difficulties in recent years. The shift in India-U.S. relationships has in fact been in similar directions. We'll see that when we talk about the Indian paper. And that has led to more cooperation between the United States and India. And interestingly enough, the shift in the case of Russia to a more realist or even nationalist orientation, but with an interest in asserting its position on the international scene as a geopolitical power, coupled with the Obama's administration move towards a more pragmatic, security-oriented policy, has led to some initial increase in cooperation between the United States and Russia. There are great pitfalls, however, in that set of relationships, because because the Obama administration, for example, has put less emphasis, potentially, in the relationship with Russia on the global economy. Russia's in good shape now with the high price of oil, but I just heard this morning about how that price of oil now looks very asymptotic. And whenever that happens, you generally get a correction. You don't know when, but you get a pretty severe correction. So if that happens, then we're going to see some real seismic changes potentially in the U.S.-Russia relationship. Well, look, that's a lot. I'm sorry to burden you with all of that so early in the morning, but I'm pleased with myself for having gotten it out in 10 minutes. And we can always come back to it, as I suggest, as we go through the course of the day. Now, we are on a tight schedule, as Deepa mentioned, and so we're going to ask our chairs to keep us on that schedule. We have an hour for each session. We'll start with our session on China. Yes, right? I've got the right one?
Yes.
Okay. We'll start with the session on China, and I believe has Mr. Medeiros arrived?
We're a little ahead of schedule.
We are a tiny bit ahead of schedule. A couple of minutes, which is good. But Mr. Medeiros is going to chair this opening session for us and should be here momentarily. He, by the way, is the current China hand on the National Security Council. So we're very, very pleased that he agreed to be with us this morning. He did make it clear that he might be calling us over the weekend. I don't think
he
did.
He's here.
He's here. Evan, where are you?
There he is.
Very good. Please, come up. And we will rearrange the chairs and the signs here, and then I will introduce Evan, and we will get on with our first session dealing with the domestic foreign policy debates in China. David Chambaugh, our colleague, is also here. And then David Lampton from Johns Hopkins. You have, by the way, bios on everyone in your packet. We're not going to spend a lot of time introducing people.